In 1915, the San Diego City Council, facing the prospect of drought, offered a man named Charles Hatfield $10,000 to fill the Lake Morena Reservoir. Hatfield was what was then known as a pluviculturist. He gave himself the unfortunate job description of moisture accelerator. But when his story eventually inspired a Broadway play, it was simply called The Rainmaker. Hatfield's specific method involved a proprietary mixture of 23 chemicals that he placed at the top of a large evaporating tower. But he obeyed the same rules as all successful rainmakers. He kept a close eye on the weather reports and the skies, and when it rained, he took credit for it. By January, Hatfield's tower was in place. And sure enough, on January 5th, 1916, it began to rain over San Diego. The rain got heavier. Riverbeds overflowed and bridges were washed away. On the 20th, the rain finally stopped, but then it started right up again. On January 27th, the Lower Otway Dam broke, causing untold damage and at least 20 deaths. A lawsuit was filed, but not by the city of San Diego. Hatfield had made it rain and wanted his money. But the city would only pay him if he first accepted liability for all the damage caused by the flooding, claims that had already exceeded $3 million.
And when suits were filed against him, the judge basically threw it out and said, you cannot connect anything that he did to the rain that came. Actually it was a fault with the dam, but Charles Hatfield was not really responsible for that rain, and the judge threw out the case. And he left the state very wisely at that point.
That was Dr. Christine Harper, author of Make It Rain, State Control of the Atmosphere in 20th Century America. For centuries, humans have thought their actions could have an impact on the skies, whether it was by praying to a god or conducting rainmaking ceremonies. In the last 100 years, efforts have become more scientific, but perhaps, as we will learn, not that much more scientific. The story of Charles Hatfield illustrates the two main problems with any attempt to control the weather: what happens when it doesn't work, and what might happen if it ever could work. But the history of weather control in America begins well before Hatfield's work in San Diego. Here's our other guest, Jim Fleming, author of Fixing the Sky. Let's go back to the 19th century, I suppose. These are the sort of first large-scale attempts to control the weather, I suppose.
Right. They're attempts by modern scientists thinking that they have the technological means to do that. That dates to the early 19th century.
And it's the earliest attempts are based largely around explosions. Would that be fair?
Right. Explosions, setting large fires. You know, James Espy, who was the first U.S. government meteorologist, proposed lighting the Appalachian mountain ridges to make more smoke and more heat and more convection and more rain. And wanted to get paid from the government. I distinguished between two types. One was the real charlatans. They might as well have been selling patent medicine or snake oil, and going to county fairs and trying to get people to subscribe to their proprietary rainmaking. And then there was the category of sincere but deluded or misled scientists who had sort of a single horse theory, and they wanted to ride that horse off into fame and fortune. And then I had some people, I was at a conference, and there's a really good colleague of mine who models this kind of stuff. And he came up and he said, Jim, he says, please, let's make a third category of like really sincere, but not deluded, but really dedicated scientists who are trying to figure this out. So I said, yeah, that's really in a minority. I only know a few people like that.
The end of the 19th century marked a turn towards more sincere scientific efforts at weather control. And this got the attention of the U.S. government. And even some funding.
The earliest example is in the 19th century, when there were suggestions that there was a connection between explosives, so ordnance or any kind of smoke-creating things would lead to rainfall later. So this idea was kind of cooked up by a guy named Edward Powers, who, according to him anyway, noted that if you looked at battles, that 3 or 4 days after the battles, it would always rain, right? And not thinking, well, if you're in the mid-latitudes, you don't generally have battles when it's raining. I mean, you don't start them when it's raining. And that storm systems come through every 3 or 4 days, that would sort of make sense that ultimately after you'd had some kind of a battle, you might have rain later on if it was during the winter time. So a senator from Illinois put in a special rider into an appropriation bill asking for money to do experiments on using explosives to make it rain. And this was kicked in and out of the budget and finally was just kind of sneaked in. And it was supposed to go to the U.S. Forest Service, which was at the time one of the scientific organizations in the U.S. government, and they refused. They said, you can't make it, you know, like this is not real. You know, like we're not touching this. So instead, the query went to another government agency, which said, sure, we'll do it. And so they took a train load of explosives down to Texas, which happened to be where this Illinois senator owned a whole lot of land with other people that would be a lot more productive if they could have rain. And they hauled them all out there and they started shooting off all of these explosives. So they would fill balloons with hydrogen, and then they attached like dynamite to them, and then they sent them up on tethers with a wire connected to a battery, and then they would explode the hydrogen balloons, which then would explode all of this attached dynamite, and mostly what it did was it sent cattle running. But if there was already rain that was incoming, it did indeed start to rain. But as a meteorologist from the U.S. Weather Bureau pointed out, it would have rained anyway because it was supposed to rain. I mean, there was rain coming in.
Attempts at weather control became popular, albeit expensive military experiments. And there was some success. Here's Jim Fleming explaining some of the UK and US attempts at wartime weather control.
There was a project called FIDO, Fog Intensive Dispersal Of, I think is the acronym. And the Brits had dedicated a lot of their petroleum reserves to burning large amounts of petrol around an airfield. And what had happened was bombers would leave the UK and they would head towards Europe on bombing raids, and then they would be shot up almost out of fuel. They'd be lost coming back to England, and the fog would set in and they couldn't find the airport. So they were losing a lot of aviators, a lot of planes, a lot of people just coming back from a successful raid. And Churchill dedicated a big proportion of the petroleum reserves to burning gasoline around the trenches around the airfields, and that would be like the lighthouse of GEOPS. It would light up. It would heat the air. It would raise the fog, and it would allow kind of a beacon for the airplanes to come back to the airfield. And as soon as the fuel runs out, the fog comes back in. Kind of an ocean fog would slip back in. But it did save lives. It did allow the Allies to fly during the Battle of the Bulge more frequently than the Germans could. And so in that sense, it was considered a military necessity and kind of a success. But after the war, they tried to put one of these fog dispersal machines at commercial airports, and it was just hundreds of thousands of dollars to try to land one plane in the fog. So right at that time, the electronic landing equipment came in, and you didn't need to have visibility on the airfield to land safely.
Right. And it was, even when it worked, it was outrageously expensive and energy intensive, wasn't it? It was something like 6,000 gallons of fuel to land a plane.
Yeah. And the land, the tanks and the jeeps wanted that fuel too. So if in your bathroom, if you fog up after a shower, you could take a hairdryer and you can clear out the mirror. So there's a basic principle. The heat would warm up the fog, and the fog would lift temporarily, and the planes could land. But it didn't work practically.
And then came the Cold War, and with it, much more investment in weather control. What we're talking about in the Cold War is, in addition to these things, we're now talking about using weather to mess up your enemies. I mean, using weather against people. It's pretty nefarious, isn't it?
Well, they were talking about using it against people.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. So the whole idea was that, you know, could you snow the other side in? Could you cause a drought that would starve them out, essentially?
Right. So this is based on an increased understanding, I guess, in what makes precipitation happen in the first place.
Well, they still didn't know at this point about precipitation, but they did know that they could get, if they used very small dry ice particles, that they could get the water vapor droplets in the clouds to cling to those to make drops that were big enough to fall out. So it takes approximately 1 million cloud droplets to make one raindrop that's heavy enough to fall out. That's essentially what they were doing, is they were using water attractive materials, in this case dry ice, and then later on silver iodide.
I guess that's what we when I was a child was called cloud seeding.
That's cloud seeding.
Everyone sort of believed in it. We all believed in it. We thought this will work.
Yeah. Well, and it can under some conditions, but mostly if it was going to rain already.
So far, the big studies have failed to show any significant effect from cloud seeding. Speaking about one National Academy of Sciences report, Stanford University ecologist Rob Jackson said, "I think you can squeeze out a little more snow or rain in some places under some conditions, but that's quite different from a program claiming to reliably increase precipitation." In 2003, the U.S. National Research Council released a report stating that science was unable to say with assurance which, if any, seeding techniques produce positive effects. In the 55 years following the first cloud seeding demonstrations, substantial progress has been made in understanding the natural processes that account for our daily weather, yet scientifically acceptable proof for significant seeding effects has not been achieved. Despite all this, the U.S. government persisted.
We then had SkyWater, which was a huge project that was really, I mean, quite frankly, shaky to begin with, but the whole idea was to seed clouds that would rain over the watersheds that fed into the dams and reservoirs that were built. And so the idea was that there were going to be centers around the U.S., which had all these sensors that went into the ground so that you could measure groundwater and you could measure stream flow and you knew how much water was in reservoirs. And then when that got too low and clouds were inbound, then it would send up rockets and it would send up drones and it would send up seeds from the ground at clouds that were coming over, and then it would rain into the watershed and then the water would come back up and then everything would be stopped and it would ought to be, you know, it'd be automatic. This was tens of millions of dollars went into this. It didn't go anywhere. Storm Fury was about snuffing out hurricanes while they were small. So the idea here is if you've got a nascent hurricane, you could send out your planes and seed it with silver iodide and essentially stop the energy flow into the hurricane. That was not successful, but that was the unclassified version of another project called GrowMet that was happening in India, where we were trying to help the government of India break the Bihar drought in the 1960s. That didn't work either, but fortunately the monsoons came back and so then nobody cared. But the hyper-classified version of that was being used in Vietnam and Laos as a weapon. And so everybody was trying to keep it secret because we were literally using it against the Laotians and the Vietnamese by extending the monsoons and then muddying up the Ho Chi Minh Trail so that the right. North Vietnamese couldn't get men and material to the south.
So that was being used.
And that was being used, yes.
But I'm presuming we don't really know whether it worked.
Well, since you can't trace the little drops back to anything, I mean, right? You can't. The feeling was at the time that it was an advantage and they were able to accentuate the monsoon rains. So they continued to do it. But again, yeah, there's no way to prove it. I mean, one way or another, yeah.
That's how we won Vietnam.
And that's it, yes.
The project she's talking about is the U.S. military's Operation Popeye, which ran from 1967 until 1972. According to the U.S. military, the operation resulted in the targeted areas seeing an extension of the monsoon period, an average of 30 to 45 days. And it's not just the United States. Other big powers have also been trying to control the weather. One prominent weather control story from the 21st century is this idea that the Chinese government attempted to stop it raining on the day of the Beijing Olympic opening ceremony. And I mean, as far as we, it worked insofar as it didn't rain on that day. Is that A, an idea that maybe this stuff is working? And B, this, and this is one of the older ideas from this, is that if we aren't working on weather control, our enemies are. So we should be spending this money because someone out there is doing it.
Well, of course, that was the whole push in the 1950s was as the U.S. government was concerned that a German scientist, Walter Findeisen, who had been working on precipitation processes in the 1930s, disappeared during the war. And the concern was during World War II, and the concern was that the Russians had him after the war. Well, it turns out that Findeisen actually died during the war. But the Soviet Union was actively working on weather control, mostly to control hail, to make sure that they didn't lose their wheat crop. Chinese interest came a little bit later, and there's a fascinating document out of China from a couple of meteorologists at the time who write how they hadn't considered weather control to be on their list of things to do. But then the party helped them see how that this was a really an important, that it was really important and they needed to change their focus. And I thought at the time, yeah, I'll bet the party did help them change their focus. So there is actually a whole section of the Chinese Meteorological Office, which is devoted to weather control. That's right. That's what they do. And to keep it from raining is actually not all that difficult, because what you do is you put so much silver iodide seed into the clouds that it basically just evaporates everything, and that's called overseeding. And this was a problem in the 50s when consulting meteorologists were selling their abilities to control the weather to different farming groups, is that some farmers wanted it to rain and some farmers relatively close by who were growing something else didn't want it to rain. And so the no rain group hired the overseeders and the we need group hired the seeders. And then sometimes neither one of them got what they wanted. Right. But there were these warring factions that were going on. So the overseeding, yes, you can, it is possible if you use enough of the stuff, and it's probably not going to have a whole lot of rain to begin with, you can overseed and literally dry the clouds up.
Our attempts at controlling the weather raise questions about how we might tackle climate change. Geoengineering, defined as a large-scale intervention in the Earth's climate, is fast gaining attention as a potential solution to climate change. What can the history of weather control teach us about our potential future with climate control? Jim Fleming is worried we haven't learned any lessons.
Well, the big basket is called geoengineering, but I prefer to call it something more like geoscientific speculation. The proposals fall into two big baskets, and we've been trying to differentiate the two for quite a while. One is direct intervention in the climate system. This is popularly known as albedo modification. Let's call it AM. Okay. They had called it before solar engineering management or something like that, solar radiation management. But we decided that, and we means I was on a National Academy panel where we decided that management was not the right term to use because it was all in the realm of speculation. So the idea here is if you make the Earth more reflective, it'll absorb less sunlight and that will cool the planet. Again, it's like a three-sentence logic. But how do you do that?
The albedo is the, what's the albedo? It's the reflectiveness
it's sort
of the Earth.
The large-scale version of reflectivity, you know, a pure, perfect white snowfield, like I'm looking at right now in Maine, has a very high reflectivity. And that contributes to what we call the albedo, or the total reflectivity of this section of the Earth. But open water, that's the concern about the Arctic, that if there's open water, it'll have a lower albedo, it'll absorb more energy. Okay, so one technique was to shoot particles into the stratosphere. And some of the earliest proposals involved using naval guns loaded with sulfate particles, opening fire from the tropics into the tropical atmosphere so they might spread around the world. It was very much based on hubris. It was based on intervention. It was not at the permission of anybody that lived in the tropics. It was just like the U.S. should go down there with their World War II naval guns and shoot at the sky. And
it's not that much has changed in 150 years.
No, not at all. But the proposal was made by a Nobel laureate. It was in a big journal in 2006. And it had a question mark behind it. It said, would geoengineering be a solution to climate change? And the answer to the question mark is probably no. It probably would cause more problems that you hadn't thought about. And I have an arm length list of projects that could fall into this category. But the other flavor of geoengineering is carbon dioxide capture. You know, it's a real, it could be a real mitigation strategy to the capture CO2. But again, the proposals tend to be rather small scale. Let's make an artificial machine that acts like a tree and it captures more carbon than an actual tree does. You know, the artificial trees approach, you can put carbon dioxide back down into the North Sea, and there's things like that. But when I was in the committee that I mentioned, the National Academy Committee, one of the members had written a book called Carbon Capture. She was a tremendous chemist who looked at all the details. And I said, what about safe storage? And she said, oh, I hadn't thought about that. They'd only thought about capturing the CO2. But putting it, I heard proposals about putting on the ocean floor in great big plastic bags, in ocean trenches, out of sight, maybe it'll stay there. I heard proposals about putting it underground, under inhabited places, but not in my backyard kind of things. I heard it being proposed to be piped far out into sea. Where the only industries that could possibly do that piping would be the oil industry with their pipe laying capacities. And it would all come at a great energy cost, because carbon dioxide is already oxidized, and you'd have to clear it, you'd have to clean it, you'd have to filter it, you'd have to pipe it, you'd have to pump it, you'd have to condense it. Lots of energy needed. And so it didn't seem practical. If you capture all the CO2 and you store it somewhere, somebody has to monitor it and do it on a global basis. And there are no, and you have to do it for thousands of years. And there are no institutions that have been around that long.
Christine Harper is also skeptical about the promises of geoengineering. A lot of the future that people talk about when they talk about solving climate change is about technological solutions to it. It's about capturing carbon. It's about sucking carbon dioxide back out of the air. Is there any future in that, or is there a lesson to be learned about trying to mess with these things?
So this is just my personal opinion. It will be very difficult to undo what's already been turned loose. I mean, we've been pumping massive amounts of carbon dioxide and methane and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere for a long time. And might we be able to grab some of that? Maybe, but could you grab enough so that you could actually turn it back to what it was? I find that very hard to believe. I mean, there are also all kinds of geoengineering ideas about reflecting sunlight back out to space and all these other things. But again, we saw the flip side of that earlier on with these ideas of maybe not controlling the weather directly, but for instance, getting rid of some of the ice in the Arctic, which we've managed to do on our own without doing this, right, by putting lamp black over the top of it so that it would attract heat and hold heat instead of reflecting it back out and then melt the ice, which would allow ships to go through without being icebreakers and all of that kind of thing. And now we've figured out, oh, well, it's already melting pretty fast on its own. And so that's not really the problem anymore. Now the problem is, oh, it's melting faster. It's melting faster than we thought. Greenland's melting faster than we thought. What happens to the circulation in the Atlantic? Does it stay as it has been, or does that, you know, what's called the conveyor belt, does that break down? So there are all of these moving pieces and a huge, massive amount of air and gases that have to be dealt with. So the idea that we could just capture this carbon and stick it someplace, call me skeptical at this point. Let's put it that way.
Charles Hatfield didn't give up rainmaking after a judge ruled he'd played no part in the San Diego flooding. Although he never got paid by the city, he pursued the case for another 2 decades. And he had plenty of other clients in Cuba, Honduras, and Canada. Although lots of early 20th century rainmakers were nothing more than conmen, Hatfield seemed to be a huckster in the classic American mold, confident of his powers, full of evangelical self-belief, completely inhabiting his own myth, very much like the character based on him in the play The Rainmaker. When they made a movie version starring Burt Lancaster and Katharine Hepburn in 1956, they invited Hatfield to the premiere. Delighted, he went. Even recent attempts to control the weather have generally relied as much on belief as on science, combined with a total heedlessness regarding potential consequences. There is little reason to think that won't continue.
There's a Walt Disney cartoon where Donald Duck is the master rainmaker. This is about 1956, and they capture it perfectly where Donald Duck is selling proprietary rainmaking. And he gets angry when his girlfriend Daisy is off philandering with another duck. And so he kind of militarizes his rainmaking materials and causes a ruckus. And then when the authorities come to investigate it, he kind of sneaks off. And the little Huey, Dewey, and Louie say, "Where's Uncle Donald?" And he says, "I don't know. I think he said he was going to Timbuktu."
Thanks for listening to Insult My Intelligence, hosted by me, Tim Dowling, and produced by Johnny Dowling. Thanks to my guests, Dr. Christine Harper and Jim Fleming. And go follow us on Twitter at Insult My Intel. If you have an idea or a topic for an episode, email us at insultmyintelshow@gmail.com or visit our website, insultmyintelshow.com. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave us a rating and review on whatever platform you're listening.